It's 8 o'clock on a Friday night in New York City. The streets are flooded with summertime tourists, but I'm headed to class.
Okay, let's now start to write our own first trading algorithm.
Just down the street from Times Square, a classroom of adult students are learning how to quant. That is, how to trade based on a set of rules called an algorithm. In just a few years' time, the percentage of trades made this way has skyrocketed. Quants are so powerful, they now control about a third of all trading on U.S. stock markets, up from just 13% 4 years ago. Quants can also use math to figure out what human traders will do, then beat them to it.
Hi, my name is Spencer. I work at a foreign currency brokerage, and I'm here to learn more about quantitative trading. I think that's a vital aspect to the industry.
Hi, my name is Dominic Reed. You know, Wall Street Journal just did a great article about the rise of quants and how important quantitative tools are and how a lot of investors are asking, well, tell me how many quants you have, where that question wasn't asked maybe as recently as 2-3 years ago, right?
Hello, my name is Claudia Hellman. I recently graduated and with a minor in math. Quantitative is the future. And because I didn't major in it, I wanted to learn it on my own.
My name is Pranav Chaudhary. I feel this is the general direction our generation is going in. You're not relying on someone's gut thinking, and that's a very exciting and attractive idea that you don't need to know what futures means. You need to be able to code a trading algorithm, and that opens doors to people from other backgrounds.
How machines are rewiring the investment world.
This is the future of everything. A look ahead from the Wall Street Journal.
From the newsroom in New York, I'm Jennifer Strong, and this is the future of everything.
The fact that they pay us to do things we like, how lucky are we, right? So, you want to go to the trading floor?
Let's go to the trading floor.
We begin at the New York Stock Exchange.
Thank you.
Where few are better equipped to show us around and talk about how this place has changed than this man.
Well, all right. I'm Ted Weisberg, and I'm the founder and president of Seaport Securities Corporation, 40-plus year member of the stock exchange.
If you've ever been to the trading floor, the first thing you might notice about now is just how quiet this is.
The trading used to be in five rooms with approximately the floor population, brokers, clerks, support people, maybe 5,000 people. Now, I mean, I'm just guessing, I don't know exactly, 700, 600. And all the equity trading has shrunk into what is called the main room, which was here when I started in 69. It used to be this room, and then behind us, the garage. But now all the trading is done here, and because so much of it's electronic, less people, and they don't need all the space. And even though it's quiet, there's plenty of trading going on, but computers don't talk, right?
It's not unique to this place. The world's largest trading floor, UBS in Stamford, Connecticut, is larger than a football field. It's also empty and up for sale. Theodore Weisberg is 77 years old. He started working for a brokerage at 15. In those days, he says he wasn't allowed to listen to radio news at work. Perhaps that's part of the culture shock, to go from there to an investment world where drones and cell phones gather real-time data. And the trading floor seems as much a TV studio as anything else.
Very little outcry trading anymore. But it used to be that the clerks would all ring the trading floor screaming at their brokers, you know, with changes of instructions. And that used to be great fun. Plus, we had runners. They used to call them squads and runners that would run around with pieces of paper. And then this board where the American flag is was the annunciator board. And my number was 280 forever. And if somebody wanted you, they would flip a button and the number would flap on the board. And then I would know by the color of the flap who was looking for me, what brokerage firm was looking for me to execute their orders. And the noise was up because the flaps are going all day long. It was quite hysterical. And it was just all part of the ambiance of being down here.
Floor to ceiling, Weisberg knows this trading floor like the back of his hand.
The trading floor itself is not solid. It's like a basketball floor because historically we spend our whole day on our feet walking around, and to avoid getting shin splints, you know, they had to give a floor that had a little give to it. So when all these computers, the fear was that the weight of the computers on the kiosk where the trading takes place was going to be so heavy that it would actually violate the floors. So what they did was they built this grid that you see above you, takes the weight off the trading floor to make sure that, I guess, we don't fall into the basement or the sub-basement. It's never quite happened. But the building itself is absolutely exquisite.
Upstairs in Seaport's office, I sit with my colleague Justin Baer as Weisberg tells us more about how his world has changed. He's had this upstairs brokerage for decades, but Weisberg says he stayed on the floor until sometime after the crash of 08 and 09.
I never left the trading floor because I just simply loved being there. I mean, I can't imagine having done anything else than what I did for 40-some-odd years. I was so lucky. I mean, it wasn't always ice cream and sugar plum fairies, but you certainly had your bad periods. But on balance, it was a spectacular place to work.
Then came electronic trading.
I was told 30 years ago to be careful as a person working on the floor because change was coming. But the fact is I had 30 good years waiting for the change. But when the change finally came, it was pretty dramatic and is dramatic. And at 77, which is how old I am now, I am in the process of reinventing myself. My big risk is that I'll run out of runway before I get this done, but I can't worry about that. We just try to stay viable and important to our customers.
It's not just the number of jobs, it's the kind of jobs, too. Up and down Wall Street, traditional trading strategies, such as sifting through balance sheets and simply talking to people, are falling down the pecking order. Trading based on algorithms, and the people, called quants, who build and use sophisticated statistical models, are taking over the investment world.
Gregory Zuckerman, I'm a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and we are sitting right outside the global headquarters for D.E. Shaw, one of the pioneers and giants in the world of quantitative investing. For years, they were kind of seen as a cute sort of niche on Wall Street. Yeah, there are these computer guys trading, and yeah, some of them, like this company Renaissance Technologies, doing quite well, but for the rest of us, we don't really care. That's really changed quite dramatically only in the last few years, where today it can honestly be said that the quants rule Wall Street. So for now, the quants, they're getting money while other people are losing money in terms of new investments from places like insurance companies and pension funds and charities and such. All the money's coming into the quants. The challenge, though, is once all this money is on hand, it usually gets harder to perform. Returns usually shrink when lots of money flocks to anything, any kind of investment, any kind of business, and such is the case here where we're just seeing in the last few months pressure on quant returns. So yeah, they are on top of Wall Street, and yeah, money's still coming to these guys, but there are only a select few that continue to destroy the market. And the question will be going forward whether the quants can adapt. Now, some say they will. What they're doing is looking at new types of data. You can track customers in a supermarket, where they go, how long they stand in an aisle, where they're reaching within that aisle. And why that's helpful is, let's say you invest in retail shares, stores and such. It's helpful to know what part of the aisle is hot, what part of the aisle is not, what kind of brands are seeing interest, etc. So the data is just exploding out there, and the quants are the guys who are better capable of digesting it all, so they could have a leg up going forward. But I would also argue that as more people come into this type of investing, there's just so much in the way of returns that can be extracted from all this data. A lot of these people think alike. They have similar strategies. And with more people competing for the same kind of alpha, as they call it, different strategies to make money, usually that means lower returns. So that's the challenge for the quants in the future.
But how did we get here? For that, we head downtown to a little-known spot not far from the New York Stock Exchange.
My name is Jeffrey Rogo. I'm the investing editor for the Wall Street Journal, and we are at the Museum of Finance in the Financial District of New York City.
The reason we're here is to check out the exhibit dedicated to financial markets and computing.
It's amazing. You know, the beginning of this exhibit has a Bloomberg terminal. So you look at this Bloomberg terminal, and scrolling through is the price of everything on the planet. I'm looking at everything from a BlackRock and Vanguard fund to the price of Norway Central Bank's interest rate. And all of this is at the touch of a finger. But we look at a Qualtron terminal and keyboard from 81, and it looks like a fake Jetsons computer that no one would ever be able to find anything on it. It has half a keyboard, so even if I like wanted to look up everything, I couldn't really. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, this is not that big a difference in time. In 30 years, we have gone from a machine that promises to do things and almost does things to something that does everything. I mean, you can find anomalies in the market, you can find opportunities, you can trade, and the biggest thing is you can monitor your entire portfolio in one place. Even things that I don't touch, I can look on my terminal, I can look on whatever trading system I'm using and find that out. I can look at my risk factors, I can look at what's the likelihood if this thing drops 10%, what does this mean for this other thing? I can look at who else owns this. A lot of times you can own something, this is something we learned in the financial crisis, you can own the best asset in the world, but if a bunch of other people who own that thing have redemptions and have problems, what do they sell? The thing that's performed best. So all of a sudden, the thing that you're owning that's fantastic goes down 30%. I can figure that out now. I know for most assets, who are the top 10 holders? This is something that would have been unimaginable. We haven't got into artificial intelligence and sophisticated computer models. And some of these quant firms have data centers that cost millions of dollars a quarter in energy bills alone just to process the amount of information they're processing. That versus 30 years ago with a Qualtron system is just mind-blowing.
Rogo is the editor behind our big new series called The Quants. He says the journal put out its first article about a quant firm in the mid-1980s, so this isn't about it being new.
The thing that's changed is people who do the most sophisticated things have the most power. One way it manifests itself is just in money. So while other hedge funds are seeing redemptions, quant funds are getting money flowing in. It has ramifications for companies. So if I'm a company, the most important person that I value is my shareholders. And if my shareholders are mostly quant funds, I need to know that. If I look at the rise of ETFs and algorithmic trading generally, they have impacts on the market itself, the why one thing would go higher, another thing would go lower. All of these things were happening underneath the surface. And I think in the last 18 months, we've come to the conclusion that these quant funds are the dominant force. And so we felt it was worth marking this moment in time. And the one thing I think all of us need to recognize is that for all we know, something usurps it in 6 months. So we're not saying this is a good or bad thing. We have no idea. Time will tell.
As quants gain respect, clout, and money, investment firms are scrambling to hire mathematicians and scientists. Among the groups hit hardest by such changes on Wall Street are college jocks. For decades, trading floors in New York and Chicago were full of former football and lacrosse stars, along with veterans of college hockey, wrestling, and tennis.
Hi, Jennifer. It is Carly Drum O'Neill.
She's the president of Drum Associates, an executive search firm that places a lot of athletes in the financial sector.
They're competitive with themselves, constantly improve in the skills that are needed to be successful in their field, but yet they have that understanding of how to work within and strengthen a team. So they have this wonderful match of skills that really works within either individual contributing positions or team environments.
She's seen firsthand the rapid changes in hiring over the last few years.
Digital technology has obviously changed the landscape. So companies are hiring different. They're hiring more quant-type individuals. They're hiring people who understand algorithms and code and people who can work with that type of technology and that type of background. The digital technology area or footprint is kind of taken over.
The Wall Street Journal's Justin Baer goes so far as to call college jocks Wall Street's endangered species.
Former collegiate athletes, because of their athletic training, often had certain skills that made them successful in the street. So one big example would be traders. The ability to block out past failures and successes and focus on the day at hand. And certainly if you're an athlete, you go through that every day. You fail many, many times and you have to bounce back. And so that kind of mental toughness that served people well on the athletic playing field also worked well on the trading floor. Even as the markets themselves started to change, looking at the early 90s, we saw waves of new products coming into be in the form of derivatives. At that point, we started to see the first surge in hiring of people that had highly technical skills, PhDs, Nobel Prize winners, in fact, who were needed on the street to price and manage these derivatives. But the collegiate athletes still had a home on the street, and that really continued through the next wave of change, which was you could begin to trade stocks and other securities over computers. We get to the crisis, and that, of course, creates a lot of uncertainty. Banks and brokers that had made a lot of money before that are not quite as profitable. And then you throw in the big changes in the regulation made profits even harder to come by. And then if you want to add more to that, interest rates were suddenly at the lowest levels they've been in a very long time. And so all of that has meant that suddenly the firms themselves are struggling to lower costs and also struggling to find new ways to make money in this environment. So as we know from other industries, when that happens, often companies, individuals turn to technology to help solve some of those problems. And so the move, this massive wave of digitization that we've seen affect a lot of sectors in the economy, is now racing through Wall Street. And the pace of that change has been accelerating. And with that change has brought a change in the kinds of skills that are in demand. So where there was once a need for traders and salespeople and other employees that were good at either taking or managing risk or dealing with clients, suddenly needed people who could harness the machines themselves, who could harness the data that would spot, that would help them find profitable trades. And so we have this massive recruiting war for people with that skill set. Computer science majors, STEM majors, those coming out of school with that kind of background, with that kind of skill set, are now what every bank and broker and hedge fund want more than anyone else.
And where that leaves us now is with many, many startups busy building that talent pool, as well as the infrastructure to support a financial sector that favors the quant.
Hi, I'm Martin Fröder, the founder and CEO of Quantix.
His company is sometimes compared to fantasy football for quants.
Yeah, fair enough. I would think of it as a decentralized hedge fund, as a crowdsourced hedge fund.
Quantix gives freelance quants access to tools and data. It also led that class at the top of the show, teaching people how to quant. The company doesn't charge a management fee, but keeps 20% of the profits, then splits them 50-50 with the writer of an algorithm that's earning money.
Our mission is to democratize quantitative finance. I worked as a quant before for almost 10 years, and I've seen so many people who could make potentially great quants, but end up doing something else, that I wanted to found a company and build a company that would change that, and that would empower people from all around the world to break into quantitative finance if they're interested in it, if they can do it, and they should also get compensated for it.
It's how he sees quants capitalizing on two megatrends.
Decentralization in a lot of industries, so Uber, Airbnb would be examples for that, also cryptocurrencies. And then we see data. And crowdsourced hedge funds are at the intersection of these two megatrends. And I certainly think that this is the future of quantitative finance, because crowdsourced hedge funds can do at scale what regular hedge funds can do with their employees.
In its 225 years, the New York Stock Exchange has seen its share of trends come and go. So what should we be thinking about now?
Broader current underneath the recent rise of quants is that the last 8 years have been pretty quiet in markets.
Wall Street Journal investing editor Jeffrey Rogo.
With central banks easing across the world, with rates at zero, we've seen a sort of steady, pretty formulaic rise. We haven't had any big blowups. We've had a little concern about China, a little concern about Brexit, but ultimately none of this stuff has been a massive hiccup. There will be one. Markets don't move like this forever. These systems may do a better job than floor brokers did. I mean, we had Black Friday happen when there were floor brokers, the stock market crashed in 1929. It's not like when it happens, we can go and blame the quants. Didn't work perfect when it was all floor brokers. But it will happen, and we'll have to learn something from it. So I think for the future, it's just important for all of us to be discussing these issues with that inevitability and figuring out where we're bullet tested and where we're ready.
The Future of Everything is a production of The Wall Street Journal. John Wardock is the executive producer of WSJ Podcasts. Stan Parrish is the editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything. We had help with this episode from The Wall Street Journal's Justin Baer, Stephen Grosser, Austin Hufford, Greg Zuckerman, Jeffrey Rogo, Mike Miller, Jennifer Hicks, Larry Root, Tanya Bustos, and Charlie Turner. If you like what you hear, make sure to rate and review us. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Strong in the newsroom in New York. Follow The Wall Street Journal on your favorite podcast app. Search WSJ on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and any Amazon Alexa device. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously.